I want to start by just mentioning how I was introduced to this book. We've talked about denominations, so we have a denomination, mine, the Lutheran Church in America. And probably the two senior theologians in the LCA would be Christer Stendahl and Joseph Sittler. Joseph Sittler probably being kind of the grandfather of the theologians. Taught for many years at the University of Chicago. It's hard to describe a Joseph Sittler, but he's a theologian that if the outer limits of thought are way out here, he's about 20 miles beyond that. It's one of the amazing things, and I think I can be proud of the church, that people that are this far out are not only tolerated, but are celebrated. Joseph Sittler started out in the ecumenical movement by really thinking about topics, can Lutherans be united? And over the years, he moved to the point of thoughts about the whole cosmos and whether or not molecules can be united through the cross. And then by that time, it's way beyond me. But it gives you an idea. Well, one of the last times I heard Joseph Sittler talk, he told us, if you want to read the most significant book that I've read for many years, read Christer Stendahl's Paul Among Jew and Gentile. So once you hear that, you immediately go and buy the book and read it. And so I went and bought the book. And I don't know how to start by explaining the significance of this book. The best way, I think, is that if Hans Kuhn, I can never quite say that. How do you say
it? Kuhn.
Kuhn. If Hans has really called into question the whole infallibility of the papacy, the history of the papacy, and run into all kinds of trouble, for that, I think Christer Stendahl is doing the same thing to us. And this is what's so threatening about this book. He's calling into question what, as Lutherans, we have called absolutely central. So with this book, he is not playing around with kind of the outside things, but he's moving right into the center, to the doctrine of justification by grace through faith, and telling us we've misinterpreted it. Martin Luther misunderstood it. We've only seen it through the eyes of Martin Luther. We've seen more of Luther's problems than we've seen Paul. And when I know I was taught all through seminary and way before that, that this is the absolute center of the New Testament, Stendahl will come out saying that it was one of Paul's side arguments to support his major argument. Well, this gives you a little beginning. But to know Christer Stendahl, I think, is to know a writer that plays as he writes theology. I quoted him in the sermon that he doesn't... Paul Wee said this one way when he talked about talk about God, that it has to be done playfully because it is such an arrogant task. And this, I think, begins to show us the sense of humor that Christer Stendahl has. And as a background, I wanted, Erling knows Christer, and I don't. So I'm just going to ask him to share a word or two. I think it helps to read a book if you know a little of the personality.
Yeah, it's a wonderful picture on the back, and it does justice to the personality of Christer very well. And if you have a copy, take a look at this, because it's so well done. You could go on and ever forever about his accomplishments and his character and outreach, so on. But born and raised, educated in Sweden and in England, and that's important because some people wonder, well, where is his big book? You know, like Reverend Charles just had his big book on the Old Testament, and Sidney Ahlstrom just had his 4.5-pounder. Literally 4.5 pounds on religious history of the American people, and so on and so forth. And there is a school among certain theologians, especially of trained, you know, in Europe, not in America, because both Charles and Alto, all over first grade, are Americans, where, you know, more is more. I mean, that's the idea that among many European theologians, where less is more, and they might spend their life writing maybe 10, 12, even 15, or not certainly not much more than that, superbly crafted but short essays, basic major reinterpretive kinds of essays, revisionist kinds of essays. And this is what this is one thing that helps explain why Stendhal doesn't have a bibliography, you know, that long, or a 4.5-pounder. And the other thing that helps explain it is that he came to teach temporarily at Harvard Divinity School, and he's like the man who came to dinner. He hasn't left, you know, in like 25 years, and stayed on because he simply became enamored with the school and with the opportunities for both teaching and for research. And to get back to the research thing again, since he was there, he was made dean of the Divinity School, and when you're dean of the Divinity School, you just don't have a whole lot of time to write 4.5-pound books. But he willingly chose a deanship and did a remarkable job, because Harvard for a long time had a first-grade reputation in everything except theology, one of the best schools in research anyway in the country. And there's an old joke that before they revitalized the Divinity School, the school was so far out, left-wing, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, liberal or radical or anything else, there was a joke that the only time you ever heard the name Jesus Christ mentioned was when the janitor stubbed his toe. It was under President Pusey that they decided to revitalize the Harvard Divinity School, and they were able to do this, and they were able to do it by bringing in people like Krister. And he wasn't the first dean of the revitalized school, but he came in and has built a very strong faculty and a great reputation since then, but has also kept up his reputation as a scholar. And just one or two more things about him. He's probably the country's, if not, I don't know that much about German scholarship, but he's certainly America's most knowledgeable person about the Gospel of Matthew. There simply isn't anybody that can touch him on Matthew. He's just way out ahead with Matthew, and one thing he's been willing to do, instead of, you know, sort of carving out that empire just for himself, is to work with other people, encourage, read manuscripts, read chapters, you know, other people's work, and encourage them to do Matthew studies, thus diffusing his energy, spending his time helping others, rather than as some of the prima donnas in the divinity schools do, and just building their own empires and staking it out for themselves. With this, so he knows his stuff. It's tremendous. Another thing with him, he's way out ahead on many subjects. He was way out, for instance, he had the most seminal early essay on what we would call the women's movement in the church back in the early 1960s, when this just wasn't being done. I think he even anticipated Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. He was doing that. He's got a superb piece here on glossolalia, or speaking in tongues, when that wasn't a prominent topic. He can anticipate what's going to happen and present new revisionist kinds of interpretations. As to his personality, I can only second what Dan has said. There's a very impish, very dry, subtle, but delightful, witty sense about him. He delights in understatement in his writings and in his humor. And I remember once we were at a conference at Notre Dame, and he was taking on the thorniest of all thorny characters in American religious studies, Paul Ramsey. I don't know, anytime you think you've got a good idea, Paul Ramsey has the opposite idea, I guess that's the best way of putting it. Prides himself on being an iconoclast, and, you know, these guys get to know each other, they debate each other at conferences all over the country and so on. And Krister was sitting there in an old shabby t-shirt and some wash pants and thongs. I mean, you didn't expect, you know, one of the world's great scholars to be sitting at a conference, you know, dressed like that, and Ramsey was sitting there in a seersucker suit and white tie and white shirt and tie and all the rest, and getting increasingly infuriated because Krister was able to handle him with humor rather than handle him with a lot of pompous arguments. And this shows up in a lot of times with his arguments. Recognize that he's trying to underuse understatement rather than clobber you with lots of footnotes and lots of, you know, scholarship. A well-crafted sentence to him is much more important than 5 pages of learned, scholarship out of 15 different kinds of languages. That's just the way Krister works. So, the picture is good, and one thing should be said, if you ever have the chance to hear him do, this picture doesn't quite show it, but he does have a physical disability. He had polio when he was young, and he's slightly bent over, and he comes down
I don't know at what degree, but he has to, he is bent over, he simply can't straighten up, and he looks up, and this actually helps his whole demeanor or his contact with the group, because he's always looking at you, just the way he's looking at you in this picture. You know, like a wise old uncle tolerating some foolish children. Knowing that he knows, you know, more than they do, but delighted that they're interested in following up the kind of arguments that he's pursuing himself. With us, absolute first-rate fellow. I mean, we usually meet at conventions, and if we can't find what is usually consumed in either Sweden or Norway at the convention center, we partake of Scotland's favorite, export, and he's good fun.
Krister is in Sweden now.
Yeah, he's in right now. He was he was candidate for bishop or the head of the Swedish Church about 8 years ago, and he won it. And would have left America, would have gone back and become a Swedish citizen again, but for reasons which, you know, quite rightly, I never known, he wasn't given the job, although he was in the finals. But he stayed on, and then he was dean of Harvard Divinity for about 10 years, and built the faculty, you know, made his point. Now, in his last years, I suppose he's about 55, and his last years, he's going back to full-time scholarship. Just a sheer joy.
Has he been here?
Not at Holden, no. No, he hasn't been at Holden, I don't know why. A lot of famous, you know, Lutheran scholars have, and Reformation scholars have, but he hasn't been here. I know Carol wanted him. Well, Carol goes after, you know. Carol, he wanted me. He was going to get Malcolm Muggeridge and you know, whoever else. If you can get Brule and Baton, you can get anybody, I suppose. But Chris, where is that?
I'm going to read one paragraph in the introduction he says about theology. Gives you an idea of his personality.
Yeah.
Theology of the kind I am doing in this book has a playful, tentative character. For, as Paul said, knowledge, even prophecy, is imperfect. If one forgets that it puffs up, 1 Corinthians 8:1, and I like to think as a child, reason as a child, for as a Christian I have not yet grown up or relinquished my childish ways. That would be wrong before the day comes when by God's grace we shall understand fully, even as we will be fully understood. 1 Corinthians 13:8 through 13. He always documents everything. In the meantime, I invite other children to come and play with me. So that's, with that, I think I want to enter the book.
Just one thing, when he says playful, he doesn't mean that he's not serious.
That
shouldn't be the connotation from being playful. But if you can do it in a way which isn't pompous or solemn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's all through the book, he often says, I may be wrong, or this whole book may be wrong, you know, but let's play with it. You know, let's look into this. Well, the way the book is set up, as Erling mentioned, it's more a selection of essays, and the main part of the book is six essays on Paul, and then the chapter, Paul on the Introspective Conscience of the West, is more of a review of the general thought. It's almost a repeat, and he apologizes for repeating. Then there's two shorter essays, Judgment and Mercy, and then the Glossolalia, and then it closes with it's Ernst Caseman that has argued with him so much on this, so he closes by answering, who's another scholar. Well, what I'd like to do tonight is just lay out the major theses of the book, and there's a lot of places we could argue with Stendhal and what he says, and what I'd like to ask the group tonight is if we clarify, you know, let's clarify or let's discuss, but to at least tonight to come back and say, well, what about this passage? Doesn't that disagree? Let's wait for the book study, because there are some places I want to really ask some questions about that. And you need to read this book when you're real serious with the book in one hand and the Bible in the other. Really test what he's saying. So, and I don't mean to put off discussion by that, but I'm not prepared tonight to kind of defend or explain his point of view over against other Bible passages. He does what Yoder does, is he takes some major passages that would be used in criticism of his point of view and explains them. He, as we know, Yoder does it too. Okay, so I'll begin. I'll begin with that. Okay, the title of the book is significant, Paul Among Jew and Gentile. And what mainly he is with the book of Romans here, and what shows the problem he's getting at is when I studied Romans in seminary, we studied Romans 1 through 8, and we quit. Because what follows after Romans 8 is the chapters on why didn't the Jews accept Jesus as the Messiah. And that, we said, that's an interesting question, but the main part of the book of Romans is the doctrinal. Does this ring a bell with you? Yeah, we didn't get to this because this isn't the important part of... Okay, Standall turns it around and says chapters 9 through 11 of Romans are not only important to the book of Romans, but it's the whole point of Paul's understanding of his ministry and his life as a Christian. Now, so what I'm going to do is try to put out in a little picture what his main point is. And this is going to blow all kinds of things, and I hope it blows some things for you because it's blown all kinds of things for me, and I don't want to be alone. And I want to say, and this comes very personally to me, that I've had a Luther experience in my life. You know, I, as most other Western people, was taught as a child to not like myself. You know, and finally Luther's and Paul's sayings about the doctrine of justification by grace through faith, when I realized that this meant that I'm okay. You know, this came as a powerful gospel. You know, and Stendhal says it's fine to feel that way, just don't think Paul was saying that. You know, don't bring Luther's problems into this. You know, that's... Well, so here's also this... you know, how we've struggled over the years with the questions of the Jews. And instead of us just going to the Romans and finding the answer, we've chosen to continue struggling. And we've joined Jewish missionary societies. As a child, I was dragged to the monthly potluck of the Fellow Heirs, which was a Jewish missionary society. I was called it Fellow Hairs. But we've struggled with this. What do we do about the Jews? Okay, now here's, according to Stendhal, if I can get this, that here is Paul's main argument and main understanding of his mission. That the Jews are God's people, God's covenant people. They were God's covenant people. They are God's covenant people. They will be God's covenant people. And not ever mentioning that they will finally accept Jesus as their Savior, Paul says that they will end up in salvation. Okay, now, what are the Gentile Christians? Gentile Christians. This is us. We are honorary Jews. We're honorary Jews. And we have been brought into God's people. And God's Gentile Christian honorary Jews are also a covenant people that are moving towards salvation. And the major thesis now that Stendhal is moving at is the Bible does not worry. The main purpose of the Bible is not to worry about our personal salvation. But the Bible is a story about where the universe is going. Okay, now I hope another idea. Where the universe is going is to the final shalom, or the final salvation. Okay, now, what is Paul's secret revelation that it took him 14 years out on the desert to comprehend? Paul had a secret. And his secret is justification by faith, or we've said justification by grace through faith. Justification is this, that this is God's secret way of saying that Gentiles can latch themselves on to God's Jewish covenant people without becoming Jewish. That's what Paul's meaning of we are justified by grace through faith. That we are just lucky that somehow God mysteriously has made it possible for us to become Jewish. And we are able to do this without going through the root of the Jewish law. Okay, what this does now, it ends all Christian conceit that somehow we are the true religion and Jewish or Judaism is another religion. Judaism is the religion of God's covenant, and it is by God's grace through faith that we have been privileged at the final moment to be given the gift of being attached to it. But instead, we have, and Stendhal will point that out, this out, we have spiritualized Paul. We have divorced Paul's doctrine from Paul's main concern. And what we have done is used justification by grace through faith as an answer to the painfulness of what Stendhal calls our Western introspective consciousness, which simply means how every one of us grew up to hate ourselves. Because anybody that wasn't in some way taught that you're bad, was anybody here lucky enough to really avoid that?
We are by nature sinful and unclean. Mm-hmm. We sinned against thee and thought we were to do.
Yeah. So taught we are miserable sinners, we divorce Paul's justification by grace through faith from this and use it to answer a problem that developed among us long after the New Testament was written. Stendhal almost comes to the point that St. Augustine invented this. You know, and St. Augustine had his problems and gave his problems to Western civilization from that time on. And then if anything was slowing down a little, Luther just got it all whipped up again. Do you following?
Yeah.
Where we're moving? Okay, so what happened then when this was divorced then is what has to be one of the most tragic, misguided, demonic movements in history. And that is the idea that developed very, very early in the Christian church, and that is that Jews are God killers, Christ killers, the examples of false religion and the wrong way to get to God, infidels, non-believers, and therefore they should be either rejected, destroyed, killed, murdered, or
evangelized.
Right?
Who said this?
Right. This is what Christians have said through. And if we were talking, this is what Christians have said through the years. If we were talking here about a problem that had gone on for 50 years and maybe 1,000 Jews have been killed because of it, that'd be one thing. We are talking about a demonic wart on the Christian church, a tumor in the brain of the Christian church a tumor that has grown for 20 centuries because the Christian church forgot what Paul said and became introspective about it. And I think as Germans, maybe sometimes we say Germans don't learn enough about the Holocaust. Americans don't learn enough in public school about what we did to the Indian or to the black. Christians do not learn enough about what we have done to the Jews over the years. And we need to live that and experience it. And before we would even start asking the question about converting Jews to Christianity, we need to spend 300 years on our knees pleading with them to forgive us. If you read the source, you get this feeling all the way through. Through centuries, after the Good Friday service, when you contemplate the crucifixion of Jesus, you would leave the church and find one Jew to kill, to punish the Jews for killing Jesus. The crusaders on their way to Jerusalem said, "Why stop? Why wait till we get to Jerusalem to kill infidels? Let's practice." And so they killed all the Jews of your hometown before you left for the Crusades. Jews were harassed, Jews were put into ghettos, and it was all justified because we love Jesus so much. We love Jesus so much that we're avenging their crime against Jesus. This we need to know, and we need to realize what has happened because we forgot so early what the Apostle Paul was teaching about our relationship to the Jewish community. Tom?
I don't know my history that well, but I thought the Crusades were mainly directed against Muslim possession of the Holy Land. Is that's wrong?
No, they were to... Well, the reason, if I understand, the reason for the Crusades was to recapture the Holy Land and the holy sites. But it was a fanatic holy war against all infidels. So Muslims were massacred. Jews were infidels.
And Christians were
Christians.
Eastern Christians, all through... and the reason they gave for killing Eastern Christians, it was to punish them for dressing like infidels. You know, it was one of the most demonic... misguided would be the kindest thing to say. So no, it wasn't just against Muslims, it was against Jews also.
What century was Augustine working, and what do you mean by spiritualizing?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Stendhal gets back to that over and over. Is that justification by grace through faith is that I'm a miserable sinner, and that justification by grace through faith is my personal way that God acquits me so I'll go to heaven when I die.
That's spiritualized.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Augustine.
And that's all the whole Western consciousness. And Stendhal, and we'll have our chance to argue with this all we want, because this is not an easy thing to handle, because this is what I was taught in Sunday school, this is what I was taught in confirmation, this is what I was taught in high school, and college, and seminary. Stendhal is realizing that he's not bringing up an easy topic here by saying, this isn't the first concern of the New Testament. The New Testament is a celebration of where the universe is going. It isn't how I'm going to get my miserable self straightened out. But it's a struggle. Can you share the reason why it's not easy to... Where Stendhal moves now from here in his book, he takes categories, and again, it's categories that we've kind of always understood, and shows how this relates. And he wants to say the category that Paul isn't does not mean that there's nothing in the New Testament about that. However, he wants to show how, at this point, we've misinterpreted Paul. Very interesting.
Excuse me, before you go on, that I wonder, is he denying the expression you just made of how Jesus atones for my sins personally? Is he denying that categorically as to be found in the Bible? Mm-hmm. Or is he denying that that is what Paul was saying?
Yeah.
Specifically, he's talking about Paul, right?
Yeah. He's saying, let's not make Paul say this.
Yeah.
You know, he's not denying. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly Augustine's position towards the Jews, but Christians throughout, probably we live in the first time in the history of the church where the majority opinion has not been to hate Jews. Because Christians through the ages were taught that Jews killed Jesus and therefore they should be hated. You know, I'm not saying this isn't, of course this is not Christian, but unfortunately Christians have believed this.
Where did they get this idea?
Well, partly from John. I think if you come to Maryland sessions on John on Sunday, you can see how the idea had started there. Where when we read the Passion story from John, it's the Jews, remember? It's not. So, okay, the first, he talks about Paul's call and not Paul's conversion. And he says this is where our first misunderstanding, we even have a feast day called the conversion of St. Paul. Okay, what does conversion mean?
Change of religion.
Yeah, you go, here's one religion, and a conversion means you go from one religion to the other. Okay, in our kind of American revivalistic experience, what also does conversion mean?
Acceptance of Christianity.
Yeah, that you have a sense of your guilt, and then you, in Jesus, there's a release of the guilt. So this is the two understandings we would have of conversion. So we've understood the Damascus Road experience, you know, the light shining and Paul falling off of his horse and being blinded as he goes into Damascus. We've called this the conversion of St. Paul. Okay, wrong, and the first point is wrong because conversion, Paul did not change religions. Rather, he was called by God as a Jew to be a Jew the rest of his life, but the Jew that would go to the Gentiles and bring the Gentiles into the covenant community. And Stendhal shows how Paul's call parallels the call of Isaiah, the call of Jeremiah, the call of Ezekiel. It's another call in the Jewish tradition. I don't think Paul ever understood himself as not being a Jew. He never changed religions.
He wasn't born again on the Damascus Road, in other words?
Okay, now that's a second, you know, by conversion we mean you have some type of experience where you say, oh, how wrong I have been, you know, and now I'm converted to either the right way or I'm converted by forgiveness of all the wrong, and then we understand that to be conversion. Stendhal will try to show over and over and over again that Paul didn't have any guilt. In fact, Paul was much more comfortable telling everybody what a good Jew he's been. We have been taught as Lutherans as a reason for the law is to show you how miserable you are and how you'll never make it. You know, Paul had no question that he kept the law. He kept the law. You know, Spence was very, you were talking about this one, kind of this incredible confidence about his former life. You know, he said, there's one thing I did wrong. You know, that was to persecute the church. But then he later said, I've worked so hard, I've really made up for that. And I've done such a good job as a missionary, I've really made up for that one. You know, this is so different, isn't it? You see, in what, where we've been in our experience. So that's his first chapter. Is that clear? Is there any... is this different than you... We used to always think on sermons about the conversion of Paul.
The only question that I have is that in the Acts chapter where Saul and Barnabas go to Antioch, and it's the point at which the believers first took on the name Christian. Is there any mention of that, or is there in Stendhal's book, or does he refer to that at all? And the whole idea has just always intrigued me, that one group decided they were going to change their name. And if Paul saw himself and his mission as that of a Jew, how could he be involved in that kind of a delineation?
Yeah, I don't, you know, he doesn't talk about that, so I don't.
It's curious.
That's an interesting question.
Where is that in Acts? Because I thought you covered all the Acts, all the accounts of Paul in Acts.
No, I don't think he, it's where in Antioch, where the Acts account said here the disciples were first called Christians.
Yeah, it's right after the collection taken up to send back to Jerusalem. It's the whole collection.
Before Paul was called, what kind of religion?
Okay, Paul was Jewish in his religion, and Stanball's point was he was always Jewish. He was a Jew that brought God's covenant to the Gentiles.
But why do people say that he had a conversion?
Oh, yeah, we're just saying that that's really the way we've misunderstood. Okay, then the next, this is really the hardest chapter. Where he talks about justification rather than forgiveness. Now, it's important here that on this chapter to realize that he's talking about Paul. Because we know the rest of the New Testament, especially the Gospels, talks a lot about forgiveness. But he says all you have to do is look up in a concordance. You know, Paul almost never talks about forgiveness. Doesn't use the word. Then Stendhal shows us several exceptions. And to show that his point is still well-founded. But rather than forgiveness, Paul talks about justification. And in this chapter, you get into the word study of justification. Then he shows how in the Western pulpit, forgiveness is the sum total of the effect of the deeds of Jesus Christ. You know, and this was something to me, because I don't know how many sermons I've preached that have said we are forgiven by grace through faith. Have you ever preached?
A couple.
You know, I'm assuming this is Pauline teaching, that by grace through faith we are forgiven. You remember always that Stendhal isn't denying that we are forgiven by grace through faith. Again, he's just saying, don't make Paul say this. Okay, he makes this statement, and I think this is a real key to Stendhal. We happen to be more interested in ourselves than in God or in the fate of his creation. And he'll point us again, our whole religious experience has been moping about little me with all my guilt. And then I've picked out of the New Testament the concept of forgiveness, and this has been the pill or the medicine to deal with what is very specifically my Western problem. And he does this with some humor, as you can see in this sentence. And then he turns to the concept of justification. And again, he goes back to how Paul uses justification. Justification is a legal word meaning acquittal. You are acquitted. But then the way Paul uses that as a justification for very practical things. It's a justification for taking Gentiles into the church without making them be Jews. What's his best argument? The mystery that was revealed to me, my God, that the Gentiles can sneak into the kingdom without being Jews. Do you see that?
That's in Galatians, is it?
It's, it'd be Romans and Galatians. He relies heavily on Romans and Galatians, mainly because the other Pauline books are dealing with other issues. You know, Galatians and Romans are dealing with the issues of the Jews. Okay, now, here it's here where you're really treading deep water, because he goes into the Old Testament understanding of the righteousness of God, which becomes fairly synonymous with justification. Justification is God's righteous declaration. He tells what it means in Old Testament thought, but then he doesn't really make it that clear exactly how it connects to the preaching of Paul. I had a little trouble right there, and that's one reason we need a book study. I need some help to really struggle through what he means. I can guess what he means, because my only way to do it is to try to draw a picture of it. And what, first of all, what the righteousness of God is, or the justice of God is this, it's God's act to right wrong. And in the Old Testament, that's a very social term. It means it's God's action to vindicate the poor and the oppressed, to vindicate the poor and oppressed against their oppressors. This is the righteousness of God. It's God's action to take those who are helpless and turn the tables upside down. This is the righteousness of God. Okay. Now, so righteousness is always the dream and the hope and the celebration of the oppressed, because it's always a promise of God that those who are oppressing me are going to be undone. So, what you have then is the righteous community. Okay, now justification has been that act. And now here it is at this point that God has justified the Gentiles. They are the ones that have been oppressed in that they have been left out of the covenant community. They have never been permitted to be in the covenant community. And now God's righteousness or his vindication is his decision to open up the Jewish covenant community through Jesus to the Gentiles. Okay, now what salvation is in Pauline terminology, according to Stendhal, as I understand him, which may be wrong. May I have as much humility as he does about understanding him. What salvation is, while it's present, it's also future. Now, salvation is the final pasture of the Lord. The day of Shalom is salvation. And now the righteous community now is that community that is justified by God. In other words, it is a community that waits and looks for the day of salvation when everything will be made right. OK, Okay, so salvation is not to have your own personal individual heart turned around and have your own personal guilt forgiven. Salvation is to be incorporated into the righteous community that is moving through history towards salvation. And he'll show why this is why excommunication was so serious in the early church. Because then you were outside, you know, the exact opposite of a television, electronic church. And what always kind of will come back to you as a Christian is that it's almost two tracks that are going towards the day of salvation, the Jewish covenant community and the covenant community in Jesus. And they're going to meet at the train station and they're all going to be saved.
What's the difference?
What?
What's the difference between those two tracks?
That is the mystery. I don't know. But they're both the covenant people. And the and what's fascinating is from Romans 9 through 11, Paul does not say Jesus once. He does not use the name of Jesus Christ. He ends the section 9 through 11 with the doxology of praise, and it is his only place where Paul does not use a Christological doxology. It's a Jewish doxology. Okay. So if you want to read a place where really late work on this is just a Christian Century of a couple weeks ago, the cover, or it was on the cover, it's an article called Fulfillment Theology in Jewish and Christian Thought. It really shows what work is being done on this concept now, most recently. I don't have this all together, but I hope I'm all I want this to be is kind of the struggling towards, because for me it's a massive mind change. It's asking me to just switch gears all over the place. I can't quite do it. Because you know, every time I go like to Ephesians, for by grace you have been saved through faith, this is not your own doing, it is a gift of God, not because of works, lest anyone should boast. When I read these passages, all of a sudden my Western heart just smiles. You know, as this grace fills and covers all the guilt and the stains of my unworthiness. See why it's hard?
And are you getting ready to go on to the next session then, or because I
no go ahead.
A couple things. I'm reading a book by Paul Tournier, The Ultimate Grace, and he's talking about how we all are judging each other all the time by our expectations of how I'm judging you all by my expectations of how you should behave, what you should be. You know, it just goes on and on. And it occurred to me as you talked here that although I have struggled to try to believe and live in the idea that I am justified, that has not brought me to the point of humility over against people whom I perceive to be below me. Mm-hmm. It hasn't. I'm trying to hold both ends of it, you know. I still want to be better than other people and be able to just and to judge them at the same time as I want to hold on to this justification from God.
Yeah.
And what he's telling me in this is that I cannot do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he might have something to say besides just straightening up a little sort of a little point in Paul that we misunderstood.
What Stendhal is saying to you is
the righteous community. In here,
go ahead, and you are justified into the righteous community. And if you perceive that you are superior to somebody else, well, that's just a matter of fact. Go ahead and see it.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, excuse me.
Say it again. I think what I heard, not from Stendhal, but from Dan a minute ago, was that if I really thought that God had brought me into his covenant people by just a sheer act of grace in Christ, And no other way would I have been able to get in, how can I magnify myself against anybody? How can I lift myself up against anybody? who am I to look down on anybody? See,
and I think,
but I haven't got to that point. I've still been able to point around and look and see how you don't really quite understand the Bible as well as I do, you know. Or, you know, I mean, of course it isn't your fault, you know, you can't do anything about it. You know? Really?
Mm-hmm. I think it's exactly the point, and he'll get to that in his understanding of weakness. And weakness instead of guilt.
Your statement that Paul did not mention Jesus the Christ in the last chapters of Romans. Is that then an inference that, is the point that the way we Gentiles are brought into the covenant relationship with God is only through Jesus Christ, that is the means by which we have gained it, and therefore the only way we can gain access is to claim Jesus as Lord?
Yeah, I think, as I understand it.
Because that makes for an interesting tension between the covenant community, the Jewish covenant community, with God as one God, and that's all that's necessary, and we then having to take an extra step to get there.
Because they just have to be born there.
Well, they, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Easier for them.
Right. Yeah, well, it makes sense. It makes sense in some way, because if God, through His righteous act and through His mercy, is saying, "I'm going to open up my covenant now for everybody. I'm going to turn around, and now I'm going to say that my people are no longer the underdogs. The underdogs are now the Gentiles who need to be saved." If through His righteous act and mercy He's going to turn around and change that, it's certainly His. I mean, God can say, but you first have to do this. You have to do this thing, which is to claim Jesus as Lord.
Yeah, it might be a little different way, that Jesus is a way that the covenant is opened up to the whole world.
See, I see that as very different.
Yeah, you know, it's dangerous when we start putting conditions, like you have to say certain right words.
And that's my question.
Yeah, that's then where we get in the area of mystery.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
What then is the relationship of the Jewish people to Jesus, if any?
I think Romans 9 through 11, Paul finally just ends up saying all the depths of the wisdom, right. You know, how unsearchable are His ways, you know. It's almost like when Job finally gave up and said, you know, the mystery is this, it's somehow, you know, I tried to point to a little in the sermon this night, somehow God is running along with two marriages going on at the same time. And Paul says, I don't understand this, I don't understand the ways of God, his ways are unsearchable.
Part two, what do you do with Paul's statement about there's now neither Jew nor Greek, or Jew nor Gentile?
I think it fits real well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're all Jewish.
Yeah. Oh, no.
But I better tell my mother
that's
that.
Not what it says, Jim.
I understand your question, that it seems, you know, there seems to be a contradiction here if we say there are two communities and then Paul says are now neither Jew. I think he was talking there about within the Christian church, you know, there were Jewish Christians and there were Gentile Christians.
Well, certainly, Paul, being a Jew and having accepted Christ, is not going to tell other Jews that's not their business to accept Christ.
Oh, no.
Wasn't his practice to go first to the synagogue,
and
then to the Gentiles? So obviously, Paul's position is not that Jesus is not for Jews.
Well, Sandal even talks about that. He says the reason Paul went to the synagogue first, because it was kind of a liturgy. First he would get the know of the Jew, and then he would go to the Gentile. It was kind of a little ritual.
He didn't expect them to listen. Mm-hmm.
No, and it was kind of a way of confirming that the Jews said no to Jesus. And then, but this was always in the mystery of God, that somehow the Jews saying no is part of God's plan. You know, and think if the church would have always understood this, all of the bloodshed that would have been... you know, and how throughout the centuries, if the Jewish community and Christian community could have embraced each other through the generations as two covenant people. And Jewish scholars are doing this now. Jewish New Testament scholars are saying this now. Christianity is not a perverse false religion, it's Judaism carried to the Gentiles. Jewish scholars are even saying, affirming the resurrection. Raising Jesus from the dead was part of God's way to get the message of Judaism out to the Gentiles. He is risen indeed. I'm Jewish. And this is happening. And then Christian scholars are beginning, and Christian believers are beginning to see this. And one thing Stendhal says in this book, in America, we have a marvelous opportunity, one of the first times in history that Jews and Christians have lived together with the possibility of starting to talk to each other again.
Are we done?
I was just in case. Just
are we going back to the introspective consciousness of the West?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, I don't know where I am here. Mm-hmm. Oh, one, he goes into a little, once in a while he goes off into what exegesis means and what hermeneutics means. And he gives a funny example of how not to use the Bible and how we often do. But well, it still may be valid that in the 18th century in Sweden, they wanted farmers to start planting potatoes. So the bishop ordered every pastor from every pulpit to preach on man shall not live by bread alone. It's a way to encourage farmers to plant potatoes. And he says, well, this was fine, you know, this was a point that needed to get across, you know, but it's hardly good biblical. Then he showed the real difference between what he means that his pastor and you have to understand this magnificent church situation. There's a Lutheran church right across the street from Harvard. And for years, the pastor of this church has been, I think his name is Henry T. Horn III.
Trail is his middle name. Henry Trail Horn.
Henry Trail Horn III. And Stendhal says he preached a sermon once on, remember the workers in the vineyard, and they get different pay, and one only works 5 minutes and gets the same pay as the first. And Horn in his sermon said this is an example of how salvation was given to even the one that hardly worked at all. You know, and it said he gave a typical Protestant sermon. You know, that if you don't have, you know, you don't do anything, but at the last minute, if you confess, you have the same salvation as the one that has worked all day in the vineyard. And then at the end of the sermon, he says, really, this isn't what it means at all. It means this. It was Israel who worked through the whole long heat of sacred history, and we lazy Gentiles came in at the last moment and got the same pay. And you see again the different. Okay, Paul's thoughts about justification were triggered by the issues of divisions, identities in a pluralistic and torn world, not primarily by the inner tensions of individual souls and consciences. Okay, he'll get into this much more in the one chapter on Paul and the introspective conscience. But what we've done is, here's we, and here's Paul.
And Paul we.
Paul we. And to get back to Paul, we've gone through two sets of eyeglasses. Luther and Augustine. And they were the two that taught us more probably than anybody else what our introspective consciousness is. And this is this terrible guilt that we grew up with that we're bad people. See, and what Stendhal, and that then Paul's justification by grace through faith then became their answer to their problem and Stendhal is saying, let's go to Paul this way. And this is a new trip for Lutherans especially. Okay, I want to, we're almost need to quit here, but I want to just mention what the other sections are. Weakness rather than sin. Paul's problem was not guilt. His problem was that he was so strong and he was so proud of himself, and he did not go over and over about how bad he was, but it was much more fun for Paul to go over and over about how good he was. But what came through to Paul was not his guilt, but it was he gloried in his weakness. Okay, his weakness was not some psychological weakness within himself that was producing inferiority feelings. His weakness was that a messenger of Satan had shot an arrow at him, zapped him, and somehow he had a sickness. Remember? Paul had the thorn in the flesh. Okay. Paul's understanding of himself, I'm really okay. You know, I have myself all together. But outside of myself, I have been given a weakness, which is my sickness. And I will glory in that because it is at that point that I am identified with the crucifixion of Jesus. So I do not glory in all these wonderful things I could tell you. And he does that, you know, he rattles on all the wonderful things about himself.
Mm-hmm. Imitate me,
he said. He says, I could tell you all of those, but I don't glory in those. I glory in this illness that is always with me, that reminds me that Christ suffered. Okay, then love rather than integrity. Page 66, Christianity is an experiment in living together. Well, we're talking about a covenant community. We're justified into the community. The community is the oppressed people that wait for the final salvation of God, when the righteousness of God will make all things right and will punish those who are the oppressors. And like in the Magnificat, turn the tables upside down. Now, Paul's now concern now is how during this time do we live within this community? And Paul knew that he had a big head, and the very fact that he knew that he had a big head was the very thing that forced him to understand love. And love is that you do everything to build up the community. You do everything to care about the weaker people, and you don't worry about integrity. I was taught to worry an awful lot about integrity. Were you? He gives us an example of a Boy Scout that always helped little ladies across the street. And one day the Boy Scout, in a deep introspection, decided he was doing this because it gave him proud feelings, and therefore it was bad. And so in integrity now, he could not help little ladies across the street. So the next little lady that walked across the street got run over by a truck. Stendhal suggests that possibly the Boy Scout should have helped her across the street. Love rather than integrity. So have it my way for the sake of integrity? No. And that leads me into the last, is that we're unique. Paul is unique rather than universal. And I always thought Paul was it in the early church. You know, and the problem with the church, it slipped away from Paul. Stendhal says Paul was just one little part of the early church. Not that important. You know, the church, haven't sometimes been thought that the church would have died without Paul. You know, the church was going all over the world with other people. In fact, he says Paul was kind of an irritating problem in the early church. He was their only egghead. You know, everybody else was fine, but Paul was the kind of egghead professor in the early church. But Stendhal talks more here about the early church. The magnificent thing about it is that it was a combination of unique people that somehow managed to live together. Rather than saying this has to be the universal Christian understanding. It's a very interesting chapter. It's not quite as central, I don't think. But maybe it is. Maybe it is. So.
Focus on community as opposed to theological doctrines.
The Missouri Synod thing would be the opposite, you know, where you have to have one universal understanding. Yeah, no problem. You know, Paul can, in fact, we'll even put all his books in the New Testament. You know, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we'll put them all four in. So what if they disagree? You know, we're a community of unique people. Then he closes then one with this repeat editorial, then a marvelous separate essay on judgment and grace, which again blows all my Lutheranism, just sweeps it out of the back door. I was taught that the judgment of God is a law bearing down upon me, telling me how bad I am. And then grace is what then comes out and kind of says, okay, you're okay after all. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, turns it all around. You know, judgment is mercy. Depends on what side you're on. If you're a righteous, oppressed people, the judgment of God is His wonderful mercy. If you're the oppressor, the mercy of God is giving you one more year while He puts a little more fertilizer on. Mm-hmm. Mercy is one more year to repent of your oppression. Vastly different than this understanding that somehow I can go about my oppression, I feel a little guilty about it, but then grace means it's all covered and I can go free. It's very, and these are the chapters now that Yoder quotes heavily. Can you start seeing the connection? And then there's this marvelous chapter in Glossolalia. I think we mentioned once that sometimes that isn't the best word. Didn't you mention that time once? I don't know why he uses that word glossolalia, but in this chapter, if the church follows what the New Testament understanding, we wouldn't have any problem. First problem is we make a problem of it. But I think John almost completely reviewed this chapter then. Wasn't it, John? The night we had the evening. Well, it's 9:30. Is there any, did you start feeling how this is kind of mind-boggling to the way we've...
On the introspective consciousness of the West, Joachim Jeremias, we're going to do parables Wednesday and Friday. He says, we want to make the 40 parables of Jesus about us. They're not. They're about the kingdom. They're incidentally about us if we're a part of the kingdom. But we want to believe we're the middle of the Bible. And we are not the middle of the Bible.
That's exactly what he's saying. The Bible's about God.
They're not about us.
The Bible is the story of God.
Oh, I think I've heard that somewhere.
Supreme idolatry is to
take
God, to put ourselves in the
Bible. Ultimate idolatry. Yeah.
You know, God is moving to His shalom. You know, if you want to get on board, fine. You know, get on the train. The Bible's about the train, not about your little guilt feelings. Which, yet, we have to take seriously because this is a tremendous problem in the West. And Stendhal, I think, says that the church has to confront that.